Good morning and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. Audience, you're in for a wonderful treat, as am I, and I am very honored to have as my guest this morning Dr. R.G.H. Hsu. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
With me in the studio is also another esteemed person here. He is president of our local Socratic Society, Russ Amerson. Welcome.
Good morning, Patty.
I was saying just before we went on the air, I really didn't realize we had a Socratic Society, and I'm very impressed that we do. Russ, how did that organization come into being?
The Socratic Society got started in about 1976 when a group of philosophy students here on campus was meeting for the purpose of viewing and discussing current films of philosophical interest. And we discovered quickly that an individual had problems checking out films and equipment here, so we became an organization and called ourselves the Socratic Society because we were obviously involved in Socratic dialectics, if you will.
That strikes me as unusual. Do you think that most philosophical organizations start for such practical reasons?
I doubt it. It's usually the reverse.
Almost a contradiction in terms. Dr. Hsu, when you were a child, your father said, when you've consumed 1,000 weights of salt,
yes,
you will understand.
Yes.
Have you consumed 1,000 weights of salt now?
Well, I did a computerized calculation. I think so far it's about 25 weights. My father never did give me a positive answer to any question I asked him. And he used what we call in the Taoist philosophy the negative approach. And if a child asks you, what is this, Dad? You say, well, it's not salt. Or it's not this or not that. And my father never did answer a single question when I was young. And so that was one of his typical answers. Wait and you'll know.
Was that, in fact, key to your learning processes, or was that frustrating?
No, not frustrating at all, because that's essential to contentment, that you're satisfied with being ignorant. The moment you are dissatisfied with being ignorant, you will be a troubled person for the rest of your life, you see. And this is very important for university students to learn.
Contentment comes from lowering your standards.
Lowering your craving.
Your craving.
Now, if your standards are naturally high, you will be high in quality, but you do not crave then for something like perfection, which is above your very high standard. So it's not the level of perfection, it's the craving beyond your natural level, which is the source of trouble. And my father wanted to teach me that.
Your childhood was an interesting combination of sort of two paths, and I guess I've given my own self away by describing them as two different things, because in fact your work sort of combines those two ways. You studied science and sort of Western scientific method, and at the same time you had lessons in Eastern philosophy and religion.
Well, lessons in a practical sense. My father and mother came from China, never had a day of schooling in their lives, so they thought in a peasant method. And I was trained at home, brought up in a Chinese custom, and I was taught by proverbs and quotations from the great-great-grandfather and so forth. And then when I went to English school, of course, I made my living being scientific director. So that is how I got these two points of views. But they never did clash, of course, because if they were, quote-unquote, a clash, why, the Oriental half of me will say, oh, no big deal. Let it go. So I never did feel any tension.
Yeah. That actually brings up a point. We have philosophy classes in every university, but I may be presumptuous, not everybody may feel this way, but I think Americans in general think of philosophy as something not an everyday incorporated part of their life, but as something esoteric, something apart from everyday concerns.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think...
Chinese peasants don't feel that way.
Actually, everybody in every profession is a practicing philosopher. Now, the question I pose to the scientists and to the other computer experts and so forth is whether they want to be a practicing philosopher in ignorance or whether they want to be a practicing philosopher in being aware of what they're practicing. Take government, take political science. It is the most important form of applied philosophy. You assume a certain philosophy. President Reagan assumes a philosophy of a certain wealth being the strength of the country, you see. So he is a practicing philosopher, applied philosopher. A scientist is an applied philosopher. He goes according to the philosophy that only those things you can put numbers to count. That's an applied philosophy. Now, so for anybody to say that philosophy is irrelevant is a self-contradictory statement. The question is, what philosophy do you want to practice? And also, do you want to know what philosophy you want to practice? Now, this is where the philosophy department comes in. But the philosophy department have not been aggressively poised enough to show the bridge between the applied life and the theoretical life. And I think this is a sort of a fault, quote-unquote, on both sides.
Is it important to name the philosophy that one is operating with?
No, because when you eat, you don't name the pepper and salt you put in your food. You just eat it. So the applied philosopher that is a practicing politician or a practicing scientist, he's just practicing and practicing basketball player. He plays basketball, and actually he is exhibiting a certain philosophy of life. But for the theoretical person, he has to name it. But in actual applied work, as you know, the moment you name it, you lost control of what you're doing. So don't bother about thinking what you're doing. And this is the prime quality that a great practitioner has. He doesn't care what you call it. He just does. Or she just does. She doesn't care what you call it. But the theoretical philosophers worry more about calling it than doing it, you see. Just like a psychologist analyzing what love is, and the love is just love.
In the beginning of your book, the Tao of Science, and I am, for those of you who joined us late, I am speaking with Dr. R.G.H. Hsu, who's a visitor to the university, a guest of the Socratic Society and the Special Events Committee, and Geophysical Institute, get in on this a little
bit. Geophysical Institute, Department of Philosophy, and it goes on
so
and on.
So on and so forth. And I am thankful that all of them did bring you to Fairbanks. You say that, you start the preface by saying that really Americans are a nation of doers, that we constantly do.
Right.
And that perhaps we need to move back from that doing is better than not doing.
Uh-huh.
You want to elaborate a little bit on...
Well, it's a question of taking enough time for reflection once in a while. In other words, even the soldiers at battle always have to have a certain number of days for their R&R, as you old veterans know it, rest and recuperation. Now, the characteristic of an American is this, that if you don't know what to do, do something. That characterizes the American attitude towards doing. Now, in the old Chinese custom, it says, if you don't know what to do, do nothing. So if you want to make maximum progress, you follow the American way. That is, if you don't know what to do, do something. Just don't stand there. But at the same time, you make maximum number of errors. Now, if the kind of errors that are possible at hand might be fatal, then that philosophy of life is bad. If you don't know what to do, do something. Now, if you don't know what to do, do nothing, then you make slower progress overall, but you never make a fatal mistake. You're conservative, you're contented. And that's more of the Eastern reflecting way of life. And the question is to, before an individual himself or herself is, well, what is the proper balance and which should I weight under what conditions?
You talk in that book, which was written in 1957?
It was published in 1957.
Published in 1957. Yes. Seems that you were... Now, I was fairly young in 1957, and I may have just been unaware of this, but you seem to have been way out in front in your sort of analysis of the way business is done, looking at the way of American corporations to see what their organizational structure is, and sort of analyzing the various approaches. You compare DuPont to Sears, I believe, and you talk... Was there a lot of that kind of analysis being done at the time? I mean, now we have a whole group of people who are consultants to business who go around and speak to CEOs and who meet with the chairmen to discuss their way of organization. Was that?
Well, there were a lot beginning, but you see, this was a transition state from after the war. Ended in 1945. All the thinkers were concerned, you see, for about a decade with the war. And so after the war, then they start to get concerned about the management of civilian activity. So gradually you have more and more people doing analysis on corporations and management and leadership. And so that started to come. But my interest was an avocation at the time, and this book was written as a hobby. It was not part of my vocational profession. And so I, as a hobby, I just let my mind take flights on anything, and it doesn't matter. It happened to be the gravy train or not. I just had fun writing it, and that's how the book originated. And so perhaps it was a little different from the usual trend of thought at the time. But today, of course, everybody had done things like this and done much better things and far, farther advanced than this book.
Well, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure if I agree about that. At the time, you were a research director.
Of the Quartermaster Corps, chief scientist of the Quartermaster Corps at the time, yes. And I wrote this as an avocation. You see, in old Chinese tradition, 1,000 years ago, the prime ministers only worked half a day. And the afternoons were devoted to a hobby like calligraphy, painting, composing poetry. And by having this hobby, which is not related to the work, they have their complete human nature. And then they have a free intellectual activity complementing their forced and ordered bureaucratic activity, and this is, I suppose, the only way they can maintain their sanity. And I did the same. You see, as a director of hard sciences, go, 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 I had my avocation of writing books on philosophy.
I think you make, however, a very strong point that one needs balance to be a competent and capable leader.
Capable. I mean, one needs balance to be a whole person.
Okay.
Yes. And you can be a capable leader and a most powerful leader by being most unbalanced for certain kind of activities, you see. So balance per se is not essential for being a great leader. Now, if you're a great leader of certain kind of activities, it's best if you're unbalanced because that activity might not be a very lofty activity. And if you're balanced, you wouldn't be involved with that kind of activity. So therefore, to be a great leader in that activity, you better be unbalanced.
You care to specify what those activities might be?
Oh, being a chief of mafia, for example. You can't then, if you're the chief of mafia, you can't have a balanced amount of Christian love in you. You see what I mean? And you want to be an ordinary lieutenant in the mafia, fine. You can go to church every day. But if you want to be the great master mafia leader, you must be unbalanced in a certain direction. So balance primarily is a matter of your personal self being a total human being and being at rest with yourself, at rest with your soul. This does not mean you cannot be a great leader at the same time, But if you are in certain activities in which the activity requires balance, like being the President of the United States or the Chancellor of a campus, then, of course, you better be balanced, you see.
I wasn't in the workforce in 1957, but it strikes me that more and more we are allowing less time for balance in our
Absolutely.
In our lives.
Yeah, yeah. We don't even allow ourselves less time to be unbalanced. I mean, we don't allow us any time to be anything except a cog in a machine. Now, in the last two decades, we have gradually come to worship the man-machine system. If you have a man-machine system, that means you got to have the man or the woman fitting the machine, so that they both are in sync. Now, since you cannot make the machine to be like the person, you have to make the person to be like the machine. And it's a total institution moving forward, a unit moving forward as a person-machine system that we're pressing in our high-speed society, which means that you have to then, for the sake of this high-speed technological society, you have to then truncate all human beings and make them fit the machine, you see. And so that is the tragedy, I think, of our culture at the moment, and that's the direction we're heading for. I think somehow or another, philosophy and the humanities and things like that have to assert itself more directly to the problem at hand, that people are becoming to be like machines, not in a purposeful manner, but the surrounding seems to sort of force him into this mold. Men and women now are modules. Like you take out the carburetor of a car, you put in another carburetor. You can take any person from any institution and put another person in and plug them in without any problem. So we are all standardized modules in our educational system, our training system, our social system, are converting us to be stereotypes of each other so we can exchange each other.
Highly predictable behavior.
Standardized.
Well-defined.
Job boundary.
Categories.
No individual vacillations or flexibilities to gum up the system. They have certain boundaries. They better move that out. And they have the freedom to be better fit that box or else. You know, that's our problem.
One word that seems to be introduced a lot in the circles that I go in, I do pre-grievance mediation for the university conflict.
You do what?
Pre-grievance mediation for the university.
Yeah.
It's kind of conflict resolution between employees and the institution and our rules. And one of the words that gets used a lot is objectivity.
Right. Right. No such thing. No such thing. There's such thing in abstract, of course. But in reality, no such thing as objectivity, because once the person opened its mouth, whatever comes out of the mouth is no longer objective. It came out of that person. It came out of that person's mind, which makes it subjective. Now, I'll illustrate the problem with the concept of objectivity. It's a story of a Mormon student who decided to write a critical thesis on Mormon history. And came the day of his doctoral final examination. One of the members of the examination board asked him, "Do you think that you, who are a Mormon, are sufficiently objective to write a critical thesis on Mormon history?" Whereupon the Mormon doctoral student said, "Yes, if you, who are not a Mormon, consider yourself sufficiently objective to judge it." So you see, this word called objectivity, like one of the famous presidents we had in recent years, he would always say, "Let's reason this together," which means let you do it what I say. Yeah, so the word objectivity, I think, has been one of the terrible words in discussing judgment, things like that, decision making. Now, if objectivity is correctly used in that setting, that means you are dealing with machines. And When you say let's be objective, that means what you're saying is let you and I be machines. Then we go on. But it's false to say let you and I as human beings be objective. What you should say is let you and I as human beings be reasonable, and let's see whether we can get to some accommodation. But the moment you say objectivity, it means rigid standards.
Exactly.
Dr. Sue, do you think this phenomenon of the use of the word objectivity is symptomatic of a much larger problem in the U.S.? Ignorance about what we're doing when we use language? Do we have a large problem with language itself?
Well, every world has a large problem. Every country and all throughout the ages have been struggling with the precise use of the words. You know, now we have our philosophers struggling with it. But Confucius, for example, years ago said, if you can define the terms you're using accurately, we will not have any argument. So even when then, because the use of words precisely is very difficult, very difficult. I don't think in our day-to-day use of words that 1 out of 100 would be used precisely. And if we try to use word precisely, we'd be spending all our time and probably we'll say about 3 words an hour. So what you have to do is overlay everything we do, speaking and so forth, with a reasonableness. And the understanding of reasonableness means that, of course I understand you don't use words precisely, and you understand that I don't use words precisely, so we get the general drift and let's agree and be reasonable about it. And I think the thing which is the problem with society at large is the low priority placed on reasonableness. We are not a reasonable society in America. We are an adversarial society. And our whole justice system is an adversarial society, not a reasonable society, you see. And so that's our problem. We're not a reasonable, we have no reasonable law. We have adversarial law. We have no reasonable politics. We have the majority party and the minority opposition. So our structure is conflict, mm-hmm. as you say.
The other night, Dr. Sue, you ended your lecture saying reasonableness is the way to harmony and cheerfulness is the key.
Oh, yeah, you heard that lecture, yes. Didn't you? Yes, yes. You see, cheerfulness was this fellow Democritus who hanged around in Greece years ago in Spartan philosophy. He put cheerfulness as the highest value in human. Not love, not truth, not beauty. Cheerfulness. And you see, if you are cheerful, you must be good. You must be reasonable. In other words, so anytime you have cheerfulness, you have already subsumed good, beauty, truth. And then also when you're cheerful, the person with you cannot help but being cheerful. So he had put cheerfulness as the prime virtue of human nature. But I think most philosophers would put the prime values beauty, goodness, and truth, you know.
Higher.
But no.
I think cheerfulness is very important, and it seems the way we're organizing society, it's harder and harder to be cheerful.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, because in many fields you can't even be cheerful and survive. I remember I gave a lecture once, and being as I am, I couldn't help it, so I laughed a little bit and here and there, and other people laughed with me. And at the end of this lecture, which was supposed to be a serious lecture, at the end of the lecture, a friend of mine came up to me with dead seriousness in his face and said, "Ralph, you got to make up your mind. You're either going to be a teacher or a comedian." And he stalked right out of the room, never spoke to me after that. So there I am, talking about cheerfulness. He's the only fellow, I think, who was immune to cheerfulness. Everybody else, if you laugh, they laugh, you know, but you know. And maybe he's right. Maybe he's right. Maybe I'm nothing but a comedian. You know, who knows?
But if cheerfulness is the highest value...
Yeah, what's the difference whether I'm a comedian?
That's great attainment.
I was told by somebody last night that the philosopher to who said cheerfulness was the highest value, died laughing. Actually, died laughing.
Well, actually, now they're coming out with all kinds of theories that Cousins. What is his name?
Norman Cousins.
Norman Cousins. That one can at least speed or facilitate healing with laughter. Humor is an odd thing. Would that be a virtual
virtual presence?
What is humor? What is it that makes us?
I don't know. Maybe you know, Russ, you're a philosophy student.
No, I would never claim to know.
What is humor? I don't know. I think a humor is the reaction of the soul when it's tickled. That's the best definition I can give.
Hard to put your hands on a tickled soul. A tickled soul is hard to put
No problem at all, because you're doing it right now. You're laughing, you're being tickled, I'm being tickled, and we're all laughing. And that's humor. Now, you have different kind. Actually, you know, seriously, people write long tomes about humor, and one of the theses was that that humor is always something made at the expense of somebody else as the butt of the joke, you see, and so forth. So for those people who want to have a serious view of humor, why, that would be it. It's a ceremonially approved form of sadism, you see. But whereas if you want to put the other form, then you can say it's the lubricant that makes society more cheerful. And other people say that laughter and humor is a form of cowardice. It is the best shield against being weaker than the other person, because the moment you laugh, it covers all your deficiency, it covers all your ignorance. You can always laugh. But laughter per se, it has been shown, could come from 20, 30, 40, 50 different motives. When somebody laughs, that does not mean he's happy. It could be mean he's sad. It could be mean he's trying to laugh as to purge his sadness. As they say, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. So humor and laughter per se does not indicate what's underneath that person who's laughing. And so it's a very complex thing. It's at least you can say about humor is that it's therapeutic for the person who is expressing humor.
And creates a receptive atmosphere for ideas and the exchange of communication.
Yes, it just clears the air out of obstacles. It clears the air out of obstacles to exchange of thought. I think that is one of its most positive effects of humor. You notice a lot of people try to crack a joke, and some of them should never try, really. But a lot of people try to crack a joke at the beginning of a talk, you see, and that is the greatest clearing of the atmosphere for that's inhibiting the exchange of thought. So practically speaking, that's a very valuable thing.
Of course, if the joke doesn't work, then it's hard to go on from there.
Well, he made it worse, you see. Then he's created a further obstacle, you see. And so I think most people, if they are not naturally funny, they shouldn't try to be funny, you know. And it's just like people who are not naturally serious, they should not try to be serious. But good humor is pretty difficult to come by, because the humor must fit the particular occasion, and the best humor is a humor which teaches something at the same time. But most humor are forced by somebody who starts the session by saying, well, let me tell you a joke, you know, then they tell something. Well, that kind of humor is just juvenile humor. But humor practiced to the highest degree is a form of enlightenment, and you got to pick the right joke for the right occasion with the right message, deeper than just laughter.
Sometimes I become aware that I have gotten some increased intimacy with someone because of the amount of humor we spark in each other, and it's a sort of sign that this is a friendship that's deepening. We have
you might call that, what you're saying is resonance. You have a resonance between the two, you see, and there's a vibration. For instance, if you have two tuning forks that are resonant to each other, and you strike one, the other will also vibrate, you see. And so you're on, as they say, a simpatico wavelength. Your vibes are in harmony. Yes, and humor is one of the finest carrier waves, I think, of vibes, to use the hippie language.
There's nothing wrong with vibes.
Huh? Vibes.
It sounded... Vibes is a kind of... I guess in the United States, we're sort of self-conscious about those words that describe ephemeral things. And
yeah.
So then it becomes fad, like vibes. I don't know what some of the other words are.
Well, vibes, I think, is one of the greatest words in the American language. But somehow or another, nobody in the educated world ever took it up and really analyzed it. Vibes is something... ineffable. It's not describable in words, but everybody knows what it means if they really listen and people talk about vibes. Now, the trouble is, it seems to me that that's has the seed of something important, the word vibes. Now, if the scholars really took that word and really tried to have a feel of what's behind vibes, then maybe we can have an advanced stage of enlightenment. But no, just because vibes have been invented by a bunch of hippies, maybe most scholars feel it is beneath their dignity to analyze this product of the hippies. But I like the word vibes. I think it has a very, very deep meaning in it. I don't know whether the hippies themselves know what it meant, but... You see, if something is ineffable, then it doesn't matter whether you say you know or not, but you do feel it.
Well, it sort of happened. I mean, I was definitely of that age. The Beach Boys came out with that song, Good Vibrations. But there was something about the youth in the 60s. There was that feeling that sort of crossed the country, sure. And it was happening on the West Coast, yeah. And East Coast. And it's true that we weren't very articulate about what it was, but then maybe
but
it didn't
knew.
Need
And when
a
you
name.
Say, for instance, Good Vibrations, immediately mm-hmm. the other person know what you want. And immediately people like to mingle with confreres with Good Vibrations. Vibrations, and if you say as a the vibrations, the vibes are over. Well, immediately the message has been passed. You don't want to have anything to do with that character. You see, so mm-hmm. it is a very practical vehicle, even if you don't define it.
Those love-ins that existed in the 60s.
Right.
I remember my mother came to visit me in New York City, and I took her to Central Park, and there were all these wild characters out there having this love-in, which was just standing in a circle, holding hands, passing flowers, and there's my Midwestern mother. So, but she liked it.
It felt very good. The vibes were good.
Right? That's
yeah.
right.
Now, how could you put that? How could you state the feeling behind the sentence, the vibes were good. How could you take that and put it in a philosophically esoteric and learned sentence? You can't. You can't describe that the vibes are good any other way except the vibes are good. And you have to be in that situation to know what it means. Just like a German word, Gemütlichkeit, you know, in a Ratskeller in Heidelberg, where you're all drinking steins of beer and singing a student prince song and all that. And a word, Gemütlichkeit, cannot be translated into English because we cannot reenact that same feeling, same thing like vibes. And maybe the trouble with the scholars in trying to analyze the word vibes is because maybe they've never really had any good vibes. Maybe they never felt the situation like the hippies had, what it means to have good vibes.
Well, now they're the consultants have taken it over, and they come into the corporations and they try to do team building. Isn't that what they're trying to create, is some kind of...
Team, you see. The moment you use team, the word team, vibes have been excluded. Because the word team connotes a certain constraint of personal freedom already they had said, as a member of this team, you will follow the team rules, and you will listen to the team captain, and you will be a social module, and you are supposed to be in module 7, and Joe, your module 2. You all got it? And everybody say, yes, and the team moves on. Now, vibes are never vibes of a team. Vibes are free in a group of free individuals, not a team. So a team means constricted vibes. See? So you cannot, a team can never, working together as a team, can never understand what a vibe is.
So going out and trying to institutionalize sense of it, it just can't happen.
Well, you're trying to institutionalize a non-institutionalized object or thing or essence. So by definition, you see, it's just by definition, you can't institutionalize it. Now, what you do, of course, when you say team building, you're not trying to institutionalize something else. You're trying to, again, form this modular component of your larger operation. Trying to have a team within a corporation. The team will fit next to another team, which in turn fits next to a third team, which together then form an assembly, you see, that could be inserted into a subsidiary of a corporation, and each of these chunks are a part of the man-machine system.
But they are, in fact, hiring people to go out and try to create some kind of good feeling.
Of course, yes.
And I mean,
yes.
I don't know how successful it is, but they go in and they say, okay, we're going to have a retreat today, and we're going to somehow retrieve our humanness here.
Well, yes. You see, in general, the better the feeling of the employees, the higher the productivity. No problem, you see. So that it's from the corporation standpoint, it's worthwhile to raise the, quote, morale of the people and so forth. Now, in a corporation, then what you want to do is to raise the morale to the point where it maximizes the contribution to the corporation. But you don't want to raise it to the point where it starts affecting the efficiency. The moment you are not in sync with the rest of the corporation, that you have more freedom and you can move around out of step, let's say, with the rest of the corporation, then you are inhibiting the efficiency of the corporation. So what you want to do is to raise the, quote, the humanness, unquote, up to the point where it becomes a diminishing return for the interest of the corporation. At that point, you stop raising the humanness of the employees. At that point, you must standardize him and fit him with the machine component of the man-machine system, because you never try in any organized effort, you never raise the humanness to the full extent of human nature.
What would happen?
Well, you'd have chaos. You'd have a lot of happy people, maybe, but you won't have any corporation, you won't have any churches, you won't have any senate. You know, so they all has to be dehumanized to the level of compatibility with each other for maximum social order. The moment you use the word order, that means there's a certain clipping of the hedges so they're all square. You know? Oh, there's nothing gloomy about it, just a matter of practical sense, you know.
Of course. Well, there have been some human organizations, some social orders that have been relatively gloomy in the history of humankind.
Yes.
They just didn't have it right?
Well, certain operations have to be gloomy, and others have to be apparently happy, but... So humanness is a matter of relative degree, and I think it is always good to have a certain minimum level of humanness for any operation, because if you have it below that level, of course, even in a highly organized state, even in a dictatorship, if you did not have a minimum level of happiness or minimum level of humanness in a dictator or a minimum level of happiness in a citizenry, that dictator would be overthrown. So for a even for the selfish viewpoint's selfish purpose of a dictator of the highest type, he must have a minimum level of humanness, a minimum level of freedom.
Qi.
So it's qi, right? So it's a matter of degree. But we generally have a tendency to, Aristotelian-wise, to talk in terms of all or none. We talk about when they raise the humanness all to the very top, or the other country just suppress it down to absolute zero. No country can give human rights to the limit that it could possibly. No country will deny human rights to the zero level, because a leader won't last 1 second if he denied human rights to the zero level. And if he raised human rights to the perfection of level, no chief of state will ever be chief of state in a way he is chief of state by bossing people around. You see what I mean? So you find a certain limit on the top and limit on the bottom. In other words, nothing is really all that bad or all that good.
How does the chief of state know when he's achieved this optimum level?
How does he know? Generally, chiefs of state achieves a level that suits himself or herself, period. He does not know anything else. Instinctively, to be chief of state, that's what the chief of state is going to do. Whether he knows it or not, instinctively, he'll pursue towards that level now. So therefore, the chief of state, before he became chief of state, had already determined how he's going to operate. And it's up to the citizen to determine whether, not determine, whether the citizen will make conditions such that that particular person will become chief of state, not what kind of chief of state the citizens want.
So the Shah of Iran, Baby Doc Duval, the recent fall of the Philippines, those people were not responding to the climate in the country or the people. What you're saying is that the personality of those leaders sort of led them inexorably on?
Yes, they will push their personal cravings on. But any person who's reached as high as the chief of state always have a keen sensitivity to the people. So therefore, they will always know at what point, a capable one anyway, until he gets overconfident. If he's in a job over 10 years, then he loses judgment. But for the first 5 years, they always know the amount of unrest that they can keep under control. And they always know the amount of unrest that they cannot control. And therefore, they will give the people at least to that level. Now, you take in this country, once upon a time, it used to be that the level of unemployment that is, quote, acceptable is about 5%. And when it starts getting above 5%, the politicians in Washington will know, boy, we're going to have a riot or we'll have unrest. So they keep it about 5%, 4%. Today, the level of unrest does not come up until they reach about 10%. And so now we talk very glibly that 7% unemployment, oh, that's great. We dropped it from 7.3 to 7.2. So what we've done is to have other ameliorating measures, you know, like food stamps, to sort of raise the level of unemployment, the danger threshold. But the politicians always aware at any given point in time what is the flash point. And they will adjust it up and down.
Highly manipulative.
No, it's not manipulative in the sense of, quote, evil. This is the way they are, you know, and our system operates. There's nothing evil to our having a toothache. We have a toothache, and fine, we'll yank the tooth out. And there's nothing evil about this government that, quote, arranges things such that it doesn't go over the flashpoint. In the sense that they do not try very hard to get it below the flash point, much below. In other words, once they get it below the flash point, they consider that that is no longer a problem. A compassionate government will try to get it not just below the flash point, but as low as they can and progressively get it from 7% unemployment to 6% to 5.5 to 4 to 3 to 2 with equal intensity of interest to minimize suffering. But the usual politically oriented governments will just get it below the flashpoint. As long as they get it now below 7%, well, that's no longer a problem. The fact that 6% still means 6 times 200 is about, 12 million people. That's no longer a problem, you see. And that's the difference between a efficient government and a benevolent government.
Societies seem to have different tolerances.
Yeah, that's right.
And those tolerances evolve over time. What was acceptable labor practices in the Middle Ages is certainly not acceptable.
Yes.
Now, you might object to the word, my use of the word optimism, but are you optimistic in general about the way societies, the world's populations are changing, evolving?
Well, I wouldn't use the word optimism as far as I'm concerned because I'm not an optimist.
Please change my words then.
No, I think I'm not an optimist and I'm not a pessimist. I don't know what I am, but because optimism usually infers little above reality and pessimism infers little below reality. So why don't we say what is the reality? Well, as I see it, the trend of the suffering inflicted by human beings upon each other over history on a personal level has been steadily going down, the amount of suffering inflicted, which means on a personal relationship of person to person, the society has become more and more benevolent, better and better. No longer do we pull people's fingers off because they didn't believe in what we teach. No longer do we sacrifice people on the altar. No longer do we have slaves. No longer do we have sweatshops for children 9 years old. No longer do we have apprentice to chimney sweeps in England, 3 years old, work from 5 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. So you find that human beings over the last 2,000 years have become progressively more charitable, professionally, better, more compassionate with time, with one exception, and that's wars. Wars have become more devastating. With that one exception, I say that human race has become more, quote, if you want to put it that, more Christian or more Buddhist compassionate or more Confucian human-hearted over the ages, except in war. In war, now we are getting several things. One, in war today, we're getting more devastating. That's one thing. Secondly, we're getting more indiscriminate. In other words, with the weapons we use today, we can no longer discriminately use a spear and kill one person and spare the infant next to him. Because when we drop the bomb, the infant has to go. So our weapons, our techniques of warfare is such that we no longer follow in practice what is called justice, that the innocent will not suffer. And warfare today has disowned the terms of justice in its most elementary way. And the excuse we say is the perennial excuse today, sorry, it can't be helped. And our present warfare has obliterated all sense of, quote, justice, all sense of Christian morality, all sense of it, because it cannot distinguish the innocent from the, quote, guilty in killing them.
That was graphically underlined by Reagan's statement, I didn't intend to kill anybody, or we didn't intend
to
kill
anybody. We don't mean to kill anybody. We just sent some bombs over. But the problem... The problem with that statement it does indicate not only that we no longer discriminate, that we don't give a damn whether we do or not. In other words, it's too damn bad. I don't mean to kill you now, but bam. Well, it's not Reagan's fault. It's just that our condition of warfare, as I said, makes it impossible to discriminate. And so you have a choice, therefore, in dealing with each other, is to decrease that sole exception to the increasing goodness of human beings. The sole exception is war. think about it. There's no other area in which we have gone worse. Been better and better and better and better and better, you see, except that. But anyway.
It does create a real dilemma. That seems to be some of the, we're sort of at the heart of the real inconsistency. This person's actions are worse because they intended malice, whereas this person doesn't intend malice, so then it's better. I mean, that's when we're talking about terrorism here and there in various countries, that seems to be the arguments in the press. What was the intent?
Yeah. Well, that comes from the old doctrine, you know, of personal guilt, personal sin, and the person going to heaven or the person going to hell. And the whole psychological movement of asking you, know thyself. Who are you? And if your intention is good, fine. If your intention is bad, that's bad. Now, there's another way of looking at yourself, and that is you are the sum of your impact on others. Don't look at yourself. Look at what happened to the others. If you associate with somebody else and left the room with them all crying, you're a mean character. Doesn't matter whether you mean to make them cry or whether you had the intention to make them cry or whether it's been passed by a resolution of the United Nations that you're a fine person. Doesn't matter. The fact is the impact is done. Therefore, if you switch from the egocentric point of reference, who are you? What's your intention? To the other, to the human, to the other people's point of reference, then a person whose toes got bashed in because you stepped on them, his toe hurts, that's all. That's the only thing that counts. Doesn't matter whether you intend to step on them or not, you see. And I think this egocentric way of looking at things is behind much of this cruelty. Now, we blame people for torturing people. And you could just see this person intentionally torturing. But if you happen to spew some toxicant in the air and it causes million times more torture because a million person gets cancer, nothing said about that infliction of suffering, you see. And so somehow or another, we got to forget about the self and see the impact on others. And based on the impact, then we judge what we are. And the moment you think of others, you never hurt somebody.
We seem to be arguing that through our court system when we're talking about the recent insurance crises that are hitting the market, assigning blame and deciding whether you have criminal intent, more responsibility because you understood what would happen or whether it was
negligence.
Unintentional.
Yeah, sure.
So we don't seem to be very well equipped to work this out, actually, as a society. I mean, we've sort of coming to a grinding halt here with this insurance thing. I don't know how we're going to leap over it.
Oh, well, you know, when they have a problem with money, somehow they'll negotiate it out. But we're gradually getting there, slowly and slowly, and I think we're getting less and less egocentric. We're thinking about the world affairs. We do get compassionate. We do have things like foster parents plan, and that goes out and takes care of people. We do have things like the Ethiopian relief, but still fundamentally it's part of our society, our culture, to start from me. And that's fine. Except the difficulty is to judge the effect of what we're doing based on what we think, not the effect of what we're doing by observing the effect.
Right. Impact.
Impact. Yeah, just watch the impact. No, we say, well, what did I think? I think it's good. Now, Lenin once was asked by one of his assistants to pardon a certain fellow for being a dissident. And Lenin said, why should I? And I think it was Gorky who said, well, this person actually shielded us communists against the Tsars. He thought that we were dissident, but we should have freedom of speech, and now he's merely defending people against our restrictions about freedom. So I think for old time's sake, let him go. And Lenin said, I agree with you 100%, but we don't have time. When you have a busy, busy, busy world like us, like we have, we don't have time to be good. We don't have time, above all, to be gracious. Graciousness requires time. So therefore, our rush society, I think this is one of the worst impact of our urge for progress. Our rush society has eliminated graciousness from existence, not say goodness. As Lenin says, we just don't have time.
That really does, in fact, seem to be one of the problems why we're losing some of those other qualities.
The way we
started the program talking about the leaders who had a hobby or an avocation at the same time that they had their vocation, and each of those things adds to the other.
Yes, and we have
less and less time. If we need to put 14 days into our 14 hours into our vocation, there's very little time for avocations.
Yes,
you have a lot of time for your avocations now.
Always had a lot of time.
And you said you are now a retired person.
Yes. I retired from the other part, but I always had time for avocation. If you did not take time for avocation, well, the life would not be balanced at any given point in time. So I always had a certain minimum time for avocation. No, my career never was my prime interest in life. I shouldn't have said this in front of a student campus radio, you know.
I think they probably need to hear it. I think that's a good thing to hear.
I shouldn't say that. I remember now. Take back what I said. No, it's yourself, which is important, who you are, what your relationship with your fellow human beings are, and then education and your career and your job is just one of the many facets where you interface with your fellow human beings, and your job is just one, and you can interface in many, many other things. But when you make your career the all-absorbing thing, what you have done is to say, I will interface with my fellow human beings only on the career interface. And, of course, immediately you become a segmented person. You become unbalanced. And so the idea of an all-absorbing commitment to any single thing is not quite a wholesome way of looking at things. Now, this is not in harmony with what is being taught, but this is the way I had looked at it. So it didn't bother me to take time away from my career to write to participate in my avocation.
I'm very glad that was true, and you've had an entirely positive impact on me this week, because I'm going to take some time off this weekend and try and increase my wholeness here, and I'm not going to do work this weekend. I'm going to I'm going to relax, and I'm doing this on the advice of Dr. R.G.H. Hsu. I have it on the best advice. I thank you very much for being here. I know that you've had a very wonderful, positive, enlightening impact on all of us here who have had a chance to spend time with you. Thank you, Russ, for sponsoring Dr. Hsu's visit
pleasure.
And for bringing him by. And I guess we'll leave you with the statement that reasonableness is the way to harmony and cheerfulness is the key.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Calm it down.
Have a lovely weekend. Take some time off. This has been Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. The executive producer is Carla Tonella.